From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross.
There's a kind of man that you sometimes meet.
On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature a 1995 concert and interview with singer, songwriter, and record producer Nick Lowe. He has a new album called Dig My Mood, which we're listening to now. Lowe, performing with Brinsley Schwartz, helped start England's pub rock movement. He went on to produce the first recordings by Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut albums of two people with famous names, Sean Lennon and Rufus Wainwright. And TV critic David Bianculli has a preview of this Sunday's final episode of The Larry Sanders Show. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air.
If you know him, that's the kind of man that I've become.
First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Former Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater has died. His family issued a statement saying Goldwater died of natural causes at his Arizona home. He was 89. NPR's Neil Conan looks back at Goldwater's career and political life.
In the early 1960s, Senator Barry Goldwater shocked the political establishment by challenging the political legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He said he wanted to repeal federal programs, not create new ones, and he cited Thomas Jefferson's dictum that the best government governs least. His campaign became a crusade for a new generation of conservative activists, but his critics seized on Goldwater's call for the use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam to paint him as an extremist. In accepting the Republican nomination for president in 1964, Goldwater unwisely decided to respond directly.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Goldwater lost that election in a landslide, but the recruits he brought to conservatism, including Ronald Reagan, transformed American politics. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
World governments are condemning Pakistan's decision to detonate 5 nuclear devices this week. Several countries are imposing economic sanctions. The Pakistani foreign minister says, nevertheless, his country is now a nuclear power. He's warning rival India his country will retaliate with vengeance to any attack. The minister says Pakistan will equip its long-range missiles with nuclear warheads. He notes Pakistan and India are drawing closer to a state of undeclared war. Tornadoes and severe thunderstorms rumbled through the Midwest overnight, downing trees and power lines and damaging buildings. More severe weather could develop today. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
Torrential rains accompanied strong wind gusts and hail, which damaged crops just beginning to emerge from farm fields in plains and prairie states. Severe weather warnings remained in effect across a wide swath of the region overnight, including Nebraska, Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin. No serious injuries or deaths have been reported as a result of the storms, which also spawned at least a half dozen tornadoes in Iowa alone between late yesterday and early this morning. This is the latest in a string of tornadoes that has resulted in state disaster declarations over the last several weeks. Meteorologists say warm, humid, and unstable air have combined to create a volatile atmosphere. Perfect conditions for severe storms. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Des Moines.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 22 points at 8,947. Trading is moderate. The Nasdaq is off nearly 11 at 8,959. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the final result won't be known until the closing bell rings in New York, but investors will be watching how Wall Street winds down a very volatile week. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Well, it has been another of those market roller coaster rides for shareholders this week. Even the staid Dow 30 Industrials, described by one analyst as the generals of the stock market as opposed to the troops, showed a tendency to cut and run when things got rough. International volatility and the continued weakness in Asia, along with the Japanese yen reaching a 7-year low against the dollar, didn't help. Commerce Department, meanwhile, reports that Americans' personal incomes rose 0.4% last month. Personal spending was up 0.5%. Among the major movers on Wall Street today, stock in Icos Corporation, a company which has reportedly come up with an anti-impotence drug of its own to compete with drug maker Pfizer's wildly popular drug, Viagra. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The United Auto Workers has warned General Motors that there could be a strike at a Michigan metal stamping plant unless unresolved contract issues are settled. The UAW says current contract talks are not moving forward, and it's thinking about giving notice of plans to strike. The plant employs about 3,400 UAW members. GM has responded to the warning by moving dies that are needed for its full-sized pickup trucks to an undisclosed site. MCI Communications will sell its internet facilities to a British company. MCI's made the move to help calm worries that its planned merger with WorldCom might violate antitrust laws. MCI says London-based cable and wireless is buying its internet facilities. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we're featuring British singer, songwriter, bass player, and record producer Nick Lowe. He has a new CD called Dig My Mood. Let's listen to Lonesome Reverie.
Raindrops are falling on the city's glitter heart. Everywhere there are lovers like we once used to be. Each turn I take reminds me how we're now apart, and I'm lost in a lonesome. Over there is where we found that little pub on the day you decided to say that you love me. I mean to drive on by, but as I'm parking up, I get into
Terry Gross spoke with Nick Lowe in 1995, after the release of his CD, The Impossible Bird. Terry asked him to bring his guitar and play a sort of musical biography for us. At the start of his career, back in the 1970s, Nick Lowe helped move rock forward by getting it back in touch with its roots. As a member of the band Brinsley Schwartz, he was one of London's first pub rockers. As house producer for the new wave label Stiff, he produced the first albums by Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. In 1979, Lowe's own record, Cruel to Be Kind, made the American Top 20. Another of his well-known songs, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, was recorded by Elvis Costello. When Terry spoke with Nick Lowe, she asked him to talk about what inspired the song Where's My Everything on his 1994 album, The Impossible Bird.
Well, I had a friend who used to say this, you know, it was a joke, but they'd say, where's my thing? And where, in fact, come to think of it, where's my everything? And it seemed funny at the time. And I couldn't... In fact, Engelbert Humperdinck, come to think of it, Engelbert Humperdinck said, there goes my reason for living. I suppose it's a variation on that theme, isn't it?
Right.
Where is the beautiful family home that I was promised on the news at 10? Like my personal place in the sun, it never happened alone. And as for the greatest love of all, that's been sworn in a billion lines and is mine by birthright, of it I've seen none. Tell me where's my everything? Tell me, where's my everything? Where are the children 2.3 that were meant to be sent to me? The patter of whose tiny feet made my life so sweet. They've been filed along with a pot of gold that was meant to cement my nest and help to keep out the cold while keeping in the rest. Tell me now where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Where is the monument I'll leave to a grateful nation whose citizens will bend the knee each time my tale is told? Tell me where's my everything? They've been filed along with a pot of gold that was meant to cement my nest and help to keep out the cold while keeping in the rest. Tell me now where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Tell me my everything.
That's a great song. I love the idea of a nation bending its knee when it when you tell your story. I'd like to do a little musical biography with you. What came first for you? Singing, songwriting, guitar, bass? The chicken, the egg.
No, my mum actually taught me a few chords initially. I used to have one little plastic banjo thing that were all the rage in the 50s, and I was about 8. She could play the guitar a little bit, and she bought me this little plastic banjo. And my hero at the time was a fellow called Lonnie Donegan, who was the nearest you could really get to a rock and roll singer in England. In fact, he was an Irishman, in fact, but he had a voice that used to get up the grown-ups' noses, you know, because he used to kind of sing like that. And he used to do a strange mixture of kind of country and western and almost trad jazz stuff. He did a lot of songs by Lead Belly, you know, and Mississippi, Fred McDowell, and those sort of country blues players, and put this kind of stomping beat to it. And they called it skiffle music, and it started it was a big craze in the 50s.
Well, we Americans knew the hit, the awful song, Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its
Yes,
Flavor?
Yes, rather a shame. Yes, yeah. Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavor? And he had a succession of those kind of gimmick songs, and they were the worst things he did, really,
well,
sadly.
Give us a sense of something good that he did.
Let me think now. I don't know, it might seem very quaint, but like, to me, at 8 years old, it sounded wild. He did a song called Railroad Bill, which was really...
Well, railroad Bill, he never works and he never will. I'm gonna ride a railroad Bill, I'm gonna ride a railroad Bill. Well, now railroad Bill is by the railroad track, waiting for the freight train to come back. Train come back, make no stop. Railroad Bill, he gonna ride the top. Railroad Bill, Railroad Bill, he never works and he never will. I'm gonna ride Railroad Bill, I'm gonna ride Railroad Bill.
That sort of thing. Simple and cheerful.
Okay, so you're around, 7 or 8 or 9 or something,
yes,
around this period.
Yes, Railroad.
and you're playing duets with your mom. Mm. So when did you start listening to rock and roll, and what did you hear that excited you early on?
Oh, well, you know, I remember my mother leaping like a startled stag across the room when Tutti Frutti came on, Little Richard singing Tutti Frutti came on, and Great Balls of Fire. I remember those coming on. My father was in the Royal Air Force, and so when I was a kid, I was stationed wherever he was sent, you know, and so I'm thinking of when we were living in Cyprus at that time when these records came out, and they were all in the forces... network, which was behind even the BBC at that time. I'm talking about 1957, 56, 57.
So you were the last to know when a record
I was
came
the
out.
Very last to know, yeah.
So you were already gravitating toward guitar, I guess?
Well, I suppose so. I pressed on with my banjo thing. I liked the Kingston Trio. I went through a thing of sweaters and nice side parting hairs, hair, you know.
Did he ever return?
What, the bloke on the MTA?
Yeah, yeah.
Who cares?
So, play for me a snatch of like early rock and roll that made you think, I can do, this is me, I like this kind of music, I can play it, I can sing it.
Oh, well, I think probably the first rock and roll that I really thought I could play was the pre-Beatles English rock and roll, like Cliff Richard, you know. And he did a sort of Elvis act, you know, when he was young. When you go, I guess you're good now. Yeah, that's, he's got this goony voice. I guess you're good now. And what do I do? I hurry on home. I dream about you. It's crazy, I know. But it's not one of those things. I don't want to be da-da-da-da-da. Do your apron ring.
So yeah, was he important, more important to you than Elvis was?
Yeah, he was really. Yeah, so Elvis was really sort of a bit before my time. My sister, I had an older sister, I have an older sister, and she was an Elvis fan. But and I thought he was pretty good, but it was really after I got older that I realised how great Elvis was at the time. Because my sister liked Elvis Presley and she liked Pat Boone. And I thought Elvis Presley was just like Pat Boone, you know.
Perceptive kid.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering if Elvis Presley would have seemed out of reach to you also, you know, far away, another culture.
Yes, I suppose so. I couldn't really quite get it. But Cliff Richard, when he first started, I understood that.
Now, what about when the Beatles hit it? Did they make an impact on you?
Oh, yeah, of course. I was perfect age group, you know, to be... totally, you know, the Beatles were totally aimed at, and that was when it all, I thought, oh, well, this is the ticket.
What did you hear in them that you hadn't heard before?
What a question. I mean, they were just, it was like nothing else had ever happened before them. And everything that, the attendant thing, all the six, the business that came, it was the reason why it was so great to be a teenager, excuse me, in the 60s, all that, you know, it meant it was more than the music, really. But I can't recall. They just had such a great sound, and they were. No, I can't think of one. I haven't quite figured that out.
Were you writing songs yet?
No. That wasn't until I did the first song I wrote. Actually, was in I wrote a song which I can't remember, but it was about I think it was in the style of the Kingston Trio, and it was about the great train robbery. You know, there was a great mail train robbery in England. And I thought, oh, this is really, I can make this like the Deadwood stage or something. But no, it wasn't really until till I joined I left home. I went professional, became a professional musician, but basically I went from earning some money in the sort of dead-end job that I had to earning none whatsoever as a professional musician. But then in those days, that's the end of the 60s, about 1968, if you didn't write your own songs, if your group didn't write your own songs, then there was no point. You were just cabaret.
Well, what was the turning point for you in realizing you could write songs that related to your experience and weren't about some great train robbery?
Oh, well, I don't know. There's nothing wrong about writing about the great train robbery either. But... I don't really know. I don't really have a handle on how the whole songwriting thing goes. I have to be inspired to do it, really. I'm not very disciplined. I know some people can really discipline themselves. John Hyatt, for instance, a friend of mine, John, he goes to work each day, you know. He kisses the wife and kids goodbye, and he's got an office in town with a piano and an amp in and everything. And off he goes, and he goes to write songs. Well, I can't possibly do that. I'm far too lazy.
Nick Lowe, from a 1995 performance and interview with Terry Gross. We'll be back with more after the break. This is Fresh Air.
it's freezing. Freezing. Wind chill is 20 below. Whole town is under.
Let's continue now with Terry's 1995 concert and interview with British singer and record producer Nick Lowe.
Can you play a chorus of the first song that you wrote that you thought, this is a decent song?
Oh, wow. The first song that I wrote that I thought was a decent song. Yeah, I think I probably can if I didn't remember it. It was called There's a Cloud in My Heart. It went, let me just remember this. You've sprung this on me, you see. There's a cloud in my heart, and it's pouring with rain, and it ain't gonna stop until you come back again. I've been drowning my sorrows, God knows what else I've tried, but no matter what, I still can't get you out of my mind. And there's no substitute, although I have to admit that some were really cute. Nobody else will do something, something better than you.
I like that. That's really catchy.
Yeah, I remember I tried to get to Del Shannon to record.
Oh,
that.
Boy, yeah.
Because I thought a little falsetto thing. I thought that Del would like that.
When you started writing songs, did you think of yourself as writing them for yourself? Did you know you wanted to sing?
Gotta sing, gotta dance. Well, it initially, it was just at that time there wasn't, with the exception of probably being a fighter pilot, there wasn't anything cooler for a young white male to be in a pop group. Well, nothing was cooler. Now I think it's kind of lame. You know, I think if I was 17 or 18, I'm not sure whether I'd feel the same way. But it really didn't have anything to do with anything artistic to start with, I don't think, except that I found I could do it. But it was just the coolest thing that you could do was to be in a group. And, of course, then we went off to Germany, you know, the thing that is well-documented now that the Beatles did, you know, playing in those nightclubs.
We being Brinsley Schwartz?
Well, it was a group called Kippington Lodge that I was in. The predecessor, yeah. And we'd go often to these clubs in Germany where you'd have a residency for a month and you'd play sort of all night and all day and all night at the weekends.
Do your own songs or cover songs?
No, we hardly wrote our own songs then. It was all covers, but you had to have an enormous repertoire, obviously, you know. And it was a wonderful experience for a 17, 18-year-old kid, you know. It was just seeing life in the raw. I was being very sheltered up till then.
What would you say is your approach to writing a song?
I tend to invent a character. And if I invent a character and put the character in a situation, see if I can get the character to write the song. The songs that I write, the person sitting opposite you now, are rather tedious and not very good. I can do it, but if I can successfully invent a character to do it for me, whilst obviously I'm sort of agreeing with the character, but if I let the character in my in the thought process that I have, if I don't get in the way of the characters working out the song, I don't bring my furniture to the house, then sometimes the character can come up with a really something really basic and beautiful, you know, that I would have obscured and not shepherded through clearly.
Maybe you could play a couple of verses from a song from your new album and talk about the kind of character you wrote that for.
Ooh, character's gone now, so I don't know. See, now everyone pats me on the back, says, Nick, what a great song. And I go, yeah, sure. And I know that I didn't actually have anything to do with it. Well, let me see now.
Or maybe the songs are more personal, I don't know.
Well, no, I don't put my diary to music. That's, you know, anyone who's had to sit across a table in a bar, you know, and listen to some lovelorn friend bleating on about the breakup of their relationship, you know, and you know how tiresome that can be. I don't see why I should inflict that on my lovely fans. So I make up someone to do it. So I'm trying to explain what it feels like as opposed to tell people what happened to me mm-hmm. in my particular circumstance. And that way I can get away with murder. I hope. Now, let me think now. What can I play you then? What about I can do a little bit of 12-step program? You know that song?
Sure.
I'm on a 12-step program to quit your bay. I'm on a 12-step program to quit your baby. I'm tired of whining and pacing the floor. I ain't gonna do it no more on my 12-step program to quit your baby. Step one, I'm gonna tear your picture down. Step two, I'm gonna move the room around. Step three, I'm gonna walk out the door, go looking for number four on my 12-step program to quit you, baby. So on.
That was written for a character?
It was written. A character wrote it, I suppose. I've got myself into a right-on state now, haven't I, with all this nonsense?
Come on, we know you really had a 12-step program to quit something.
Yeah.
Confess.
Did it all myself.
Nick Lowe from a 1995 interview with Terry Gross. Lowe has a new CD called Dig My Mood. We'll hear more of their conversation and more of Lowe's music in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Faithless lover, heartless thing, for you I'll swing and for no other. Faithless lover, faithless lover, faithless lover. Under your spell I fell, now I discover. Faithless lover, faith no more.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new CDs from Sean Lennon and Rufus Wainwright. David Bianculli previews the final episode of The Larry Sanders Show and more of our concert with Nick Lowe.
I live on a battlefield, surrounded by the ruins of the love we built, and then destroyed between us. The smoke has cleared as I stumble through the rubble. I'm a dazed, seeing double, and I'm truly mystified. My new home is a shell hole filled with tears and a muddy water and bits of broken heart all around. There is desolation and the scenes of a devastation of a love being torn apart. I live on a battlefield, I live on a battlefield, I live on a battlefield, the one where not one single drop of our blood has spilled.
is no less horrifying. Sweet memories, memories of a bygone situation. Now shattered, Lord, and battered.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. We're back with the second half of our performance and interview with British singer, songwriter, guitarist, and record producer Nick Lowe. Lowe was a member of the groups Brinsley Schwartz, Rockpile, and Little Village, and has produced records by Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. His new CD is called Dig My Mood. Terry Gross spoke with Nick Lowe in 1995.
You had mentioned before that your father was in the Royal Air Force, so you traveled according to where he was stationed. Mm. I'm wondering if he or other parents that you knew listened to music that you really didn't like, that you saw your music as being in opposition to.
Well, actually, my dad is quite cloth-eared, really. His idea of heaven is... well, you know, I always used to think that he was cloth-eared. In fact, he's do you know that expression?
No.
Oh, well, I mean, he hasn't got any musical, any sense of music at all. But in actual fact, the older I've got, I realise that he was onto a couple of good things. His idea of heaven back then was, because he's a very sociable man, and his idea of heaven then was sort of Xavier Cugat's Latin Holiday album, you know, on tape at very low volume with all his friends round, you know, so they could all talk over it. And I think he thought his for a long time he thought the best record ever made was the Limbo, but do the Limbo Rock by Chubby Checker. In fact, he couldn't understand why anybody wanted to make any more records after that. you know, they'd reached a pinnacle.
So, what did he think of your songs?
Well, he used to rather endure my records. You know, I'd come home with my mother would get all tearful, you know, and love it. You know, my dad would be shifting uncomfortably in his in his chair, and he'd rather have to endure it. but actually, my last two or three records, he really likes it now, and he gets my act a lot more now.
You had a song, "What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding," that was on the soundtrack for The Bodyguard.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
And I mean, that record, mostly Whitney Houston stuff, sold gazillions.
What are you saying? You're saying that nobody went out and bought the Bodyguard album for my song? What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding? How dare you?
I saw the movie, and I don't remember the song. Where was it used?
Well, I'm not going to tell you if you don't know. Actually, I haven't got a clue. I haven't even seen it.
You haven't seen it?
No.
You're not that curious that you'd go out and even rent it on video?
No, I'm not, actually. I'm not a... Well, I shouldn't say this on the radio. It's a tremendous film, and I'm very, very pleased about everything. Now, I know lots of people who have seen it, and they all tell me that my song isn't in it at all. And even my mother, who has ears like a mum, has sat and watched it. And she said that she couldn't hear it anywhere. But I presume it's on a car radio or something playing in the background.
Right, there's a lot of music like that on jukeboxes. And...
Mm. But I had nothing to do with it at all. You know, I don't feel... It was a fantastic payday for me, you know. But I've been writing songs for a long time, and it's a bit like fishing. You know, if you have enough hooks in the water, you know, off the pier, then sooner or later the one fish in the harbour will swim round and bite one of them, you know. So I don't, you know, I just figure I just got lucky. I don't feel any great sense of triumph or anything about it. But it's very handy because it's coincided with, you know, it came along at a time when I got dropped by Warner Brothers. It was my record company beforehand. And so it's enabled me not to miss the record company check, you know, and I can finance my thing properly and do something which is elegant and so that I don't feel I'm wasting my time with.
Well, it's a great song. Can you do a couple of verses for us?
Sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
as I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity. Oh, yes, I ask myself, is all hope gone? Is there only pain, hatred, and misery? Oh, yeah. And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
That's a great song. Elvis Costello recorded that too.
Well, he really brought it to the public's attention. You know, I recorded it with Brinsley Schwartz, that I wrote the song for back in about 73 or 74. And Elvis recorded it and brought it to everyone's attention, really. In fact, a lot of people really think of it as it being Elvis's song.
Well, what was the original tone that you meant that song to have? Irony, serious?
Yeah, it was meant to be a sort of joke, really. I thought it was really pompous, you know, as I walk this wicked world. You know, here I was 22, you know, 22 years old and seen it all. And I thought it was a sort of a joke, you know, except I thought the title was good. I thought that was good. But when Elvis cut it, he really sounded like he meant it and thought it was you know, he made it sort of anthemic. And if I can use a word, I suppose I can on public radio, can't I? Anthemic. But he really gave it some soul and charged it up.
So did you find yourself singing it differently after hearing him sing it?
Well, I certainly saw it differently. Yeah, I certainly did see it differently, and because it turned people on so much, and you could see how much people really identified with it and liked it, and you can't knock that, you know, when that happens, because there's no rhyme or reason to it why people will grab onto something, and when it happens, it's a wonderful thing.
Something I like to do during one of our concerts on the show is to ask the performer to sing a song, not one of their own, that we might think of as being totally out of character. So let me ask you if you could think of something to do a song that you really love that we might be surprised to hear that you love.
Wow. Well, I might not know all the words.
That's okay.
I can sort of... I hope I get this right. And I hope this falls into the category that you're... Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game. All in the wonderful game that we know. You may cling to him, and your future's looking grim. Do do do, do do. Once in a while he won't call, but it's all in the game. Soon he'll be there at your side with a sweet bouquet. Then he'll kiss your lips and caress your waiting fingertips, and your heart will fly away.
and your heart will fly away.
That's great.
Terry Groves speaking with Nick Lowe in 1995. That last song he did was a number one hit in 1958, recorded by Tommy Edwards. Nick Lowe's new CD, Dig My Mood, is on Upstart Records. Let's hear a song from it called What Lack of Love Has Done.
Well, I go around the world, and this is what I do. I say love's a hurting thing, 'cause I know it to be true. When I get up in the spotlight, and my story has begun, I'll try to explain what lack of love has done. And though I do it nightly, it never is the same. For it's a never-ending story of jealousy and blame. I know what you're saying, there is nowhere to run from what lack of love has done. I go around the world, and this is what I do. I climb up on a stage, and I tell them about you. Try to keep it short, I don't want it to get old, so you sympathize after it's been told. Well, I hear what you're saying, that I'm on the run, but there is no way. Lack of love has done. No, there is nowhere to run from what lack of love has done. What lack of love has done. What lack of love has done. What lack of love has done.
Nick Lowe is on tour now in the U.S. He performs on June 9th in San Francisco, then continues with stops in many cities, including Los Angeles, Austin, Dallas, Minneapolis, Chicago, Philadelphia, and New York. Nick Lowe will join Terry sometime soon for another interview and performance featuring music from his new album. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews two new debut CDs. This is Fresh Air. Sean Lennon is the son of John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and Rufus Wainwright is the son of Loudon Wainwright and Kate McGarrigle. Both young men in their 20s have just released debut albums, and rock critic Ken Tucker has these thoughts on whether talent is in the genes or not.
She won't speak to me, won't speak, and it's all my own fault. Baby, I'm afraid to let you go. Stole the show and towed the rowboat. Those slow are on the go like rabbits snow.
Right off the bat, what you notice about Sean Lennon's debut disc, Into the Sun, is that he shares his parents' fondness for deceptive simplicity, for imbuing elementary rock melodies with harmonic and lyrical twists. The result here is both willfully naive and often shrewd.
If you ever think too much, it's not enough to get you off. If you ever get too close to the edge, and don't look off, cause you never know when you might fall down. Get in line.
Lennon's collection was produced by Yuka Honda, the keyboardist for the avant-garde pop act Chibo Matto, as well as being Lennon's girlfriend. Together, they've made an album that coheres more as a clever collection of influences than as a showcase for an original talent. Leaping from the Beatles to the Beach Boys to Burt Bacharach to John McLaughlin's Mahavishnu Orchestra, Sean's music is more often coming across as pleasant, airy, and wispy. His father's band used to sing, "Boy, you've got to carry that weight." Sean is resisting.
I'm a tree with the leaves and the breeze, free in the air with the roots underneath me. Every time that I walk at the door, I'm alone in a world that I don't seem fit for.
Unlike Sean Lennon, just there singing about his insecurity, Rufus Wainwright makes bold, confident music that sounds almost nothing like that of his parents. Where Loudon Wainwright and Kate McGarrigle make variations of folk music, corrosively funny and astringently beautiful, respectively, Rufus makes a mixture of pop, rock, and Broadway show tunes. And instead of strumming a guitar, he hammers a piano.
The boys and girls of Millbrook are on the train from New York, wearing new hats, shooting the shit deep in the heart of Dutchess County Bounty. And all the evening breakdowns will soon be washed from their hands. The next very day,
there's a cinematic sweep, a deceptively casual, tossed-off ambition to Rufus Wainwright's work that makes his self-titled debut something of a thrill. He's brash and brassy and sometimes too florid for his own good, but the guy has a gift for the sexy drama of romance with a string section provided by Van Dyke Parks.
Nothing so bright, nothing so small, nothing so pure as my baby.
Rufus's parents divorced when he was little, and he was raised primarily in Quebec by his mother. If his music doesn't possess his father's mordant wit, it does have something of the tart poignancy of Kate and Anna McGarrigle. This quality is ringingly clear on this lovely song about the beauty mark on his mother's mouth.
I never had it, I never wanted it, I never had your beauty mark. Oh, did I have your black hair and hazel eyes? My early childhood was not as simple as your set in the country. No, I did not have a fear of none to dressed in black, but I do have your taste. I had no.
If I had to make a guess, I'd say that Sean Lennon will be given a grace period to mature into something more than a talented neophyte, while Rufus will have to hustle to get his ambitious but commercially unclassifiable music heard. He deserves a break, or at least a strong cult following, because his album will take you places no one else is exploring these days.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly.
Oh, what a shame that your pockets still bleed on St. Valentine's, and you sat in a chair thinking, boy, I'm such a...
Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the last episode of The Larry Sanders Show. This is Fresh Air. This Sunday, after six seasons, HBO's The Larry Sanders Show presents its final episode, in which the fictional talk show host played by Gary Shandling is doing the same thing as Shandling, intentionally ending his own show and trying to make it a great one. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
From the beginning, The Larry Sanders Show has had impeccable timing. It started out in 1992, just in time for the so-called late-night wars between Jay Leno and Dave Letterman. And 6 years later, it's going out the same month as Seinfeld, presenting a last episode that won't get a fraction of the hype of that series' farewell, but which deserves to be seen by just as many viewers. Jerry Seinfeld himself, by the way, shows up on this last episode of Larry Sanders to congratulate Larry on getting out at the right time on his own terms. And lots of other real celebrities show up, too, from Carol Burnett and Ellen DeGeneres to Tom Petty and Sean Penn. That's because the delightful gimmick behind this series, like that of an earlier HBO series, Tanner 88, which dealt with presidential politics, is that while the central characters on the show are fictional, most of the people around them are real. What's even better, these real people are encouraged to be as unpolished as possible and seem to delight in deflating their own public images. In the final episode, Tom Petty picks fights in the green room with both Greg Kinnear and Clint Black. David Duchovny flirts with Larry aggressively. Even Warren Beatty shows up on Sunday's Larry Sanders Show, making his first TV series appearance since playing Milton Armitage on The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis about 40 years ago. He's there, though, only because Shandling's Larry has chased him down in the studio parking lot. And Beatty's appearance is as brief and as cold as it is hilarious.
Hey, Warren.
Hey, Larry.
Hey. Listen, how would you, like to come on my show tomorrow night and just say a little goodbye to me? Because, you know, it's the end of the whole thing tomorrow night.
I could say goodbye to you now.
No, but there are no cameras or anything here. Tomorrow night, millions of people. We got a fantastic show.
Yeah, who you got?
We have Carol Burnett. We have Greg Kinnear, Sean Penn, Tom Petty, Clint Black.
Who?
Clint Black. He's a country music singer. He's going to sing goodbye to me. It's going to be fantastic.
Goodbye.
The amazing thing about the Larry Sanders Show is that it works brilliantly on two levels. Shandling's Larry, his manager Artie, played by Rip Torn, and his sidekick Hank, played by Jeffrey Tambor, manage in this series to put out a great show of their own. The final show within a show has many echoes of Johnny Carson's Last Tonight Show episodes, including several celebrities who serenade Larry like Bette Midler sang to Johnny. And Jim Carrey, in a high-energy sequence where he jokes, leads the crowd in a chant, and sings his own farewell to Larry, is a genuine showstopper. But the other level of the Larry Sanders Show, which explores what happens in Larry's life when the cameras go off, is just as riveting. Seconds after Carrey wows the crowd in his segment on Larry's farewell show, Carrey leans in during the commercial break and lets Larry know how he really feels about it.
I don't know how to thank you. That was so fantastic.
Let's just cut the crap, Larry, okay? I never liked my work.
Huh?
Until I got hugely famous.
That is not true. I happen to...
What are you
going to
do now? Movies? I'll crush you.
Are you doing a bit now?
Larry, we're off the air. This is real life now. Can I be honest with you?
Yeah.
I'm here for three good reasons. Last show, big ratings, movie coming out. Bim, bam, boom. Otherwise, I'd be sitting home watching Nightline.
As usual.
The Larry Sanders Show always has been about real life. And true to form, this last episode doesn't end when Larry's show does. Larry gets to sit on a solitary stool like Carson did and choke up while saying goodbye. But though that's the last we saw of Carson, we get to keep watching Larry for one final series of scenes in which he, Hank, and Artie reconvene in the empty studio. That ending is dramatic, intensely acted, and, just like the rest of this fabulous series, very satisfying, very daring, and very, very memorable. Don't miss it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's program was produced by Kathy Wolf. Our engineers this week are Fred Snyder, Bob Purdick, Chris Fraley, and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Billie Tipton. She was a jazz musician who passed as a man for nearly 50 years until her death. Diane Middlebrook has written about Tipton in her new book, Suits Me. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.